That's how I felt when I got in with Georgia Mental Health. Before, I was just a fan. But once I plugged into the correct power source, I started operating in my purpose, and the people that I encountered, they started benefiting from me walking in my purpose.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery. A show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. Before we get started, we want to be really clear that nothing shared here is on behalf of any recovery program, treatment facility, or organization. We're speaking only from our own experiences. We support all pathways to sobriety and recovery, and our goal is simple: to help people feel less alone and suffer less. Joining us tonight is Rashad Roberts, a person in long-term recovery. He's here to talk about substance abuse, mental health, and life after incarceration. Working with the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network and Grady Hospital in the Housing Department, thank you for joining us tonight to share your experience with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
So to get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do? What is the Housing Department at Grady Hospital? What is the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network?
Good. The Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network is one of the leading organizations in Georgia that advocate different positions for certified peer specialists, forensic peer mentors. They also offer training programs and certifications for us to be certified in those fields. And what we do is, I got certified through them as a forensic peer mentor. What that is someone that goes into the prison system, someone who has lived experience, and I deal with the peers who have about maybe 180 days or less left on their time before they reenter society. And we start doing like double trouble groups in recovery. We start formulating a plan. And anything that they feel they need, we support them in whatever it is they need to make that transition a successful one. So I've been with them now for about 2 years. I also work in the other department with Georgia Mental Health at the Respite Center. That's a place where people can come in off the street or even from home. If life just seems a little bit overwhelming, they can come in there for a few days and just get like a mental reset. So now with Grady, I'm in the housing department. Someone will come to Grady, they'll get an assessment. If during that assessment they find that they have a mental health diagnosis, we see if they qualify for certain vouchers through Grady. And once they qualify for the voucher, I'll be the case manager that will come out to the facility. When it's time to renew your lease, I'll walk you through the steps. If something's going wrong with the unit, if you need me to advocate between you and the landlord or you and the leasing office, I'll be that person there to help you and kind of support you in whatever it is you think you need.
Oh, well, so it sounds like you're really there to just hold someone's hand while they navigate life, like in the way of like people like, oh, I never got the instruction manual. You're the instruction manual.
So to speak. Yeah.
That's really cool, though, like for someone to be able to have someone, like if they're having issues with like their landlord and they don't know what to do, to have someone that they can call and advocate for them. Because I know that's like I think that's just a struggle that people face a lot that isn't necessarily talked about so much, as opposed to just like, oh yeah, landlords just suck. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
well, here,
yeah,
I'll talk to them for you. I got this.
I wish I would have known you when I got sober, because I mean, they're just like, yeah, it's going to be all these fees to break your lease, take it or leave it. And I tried to, you know, be like, oh, well, you know, I'm in treatment and maybe this. They're like, no. So I currently owe them $4,000. So if you have any advice.
Or a job.
I would say pay them folks their money.
Hey, I was hoping you'd say something else, you know?
They actually owe you $4,000.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, I got to pay them. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us a little bit too about like a brief overview of, you know, your history and how you landed working in such like an advocacy role.
Okay, so wow. So, you know, early on in life, I believe I was raised in what would be a quote unquote normal household. I had a family member or two that was involved and had issues with substance abuse. And then in spite of the upbringing that my mom gave me, who laid the groundwork for a right course, I still chose to venture the other way. And in venturing the other way, I encountered a whole series of people who didn't really know how to deal with their emotions other than to self-medicate. So I started doing that at a young age, as a teenager, and just spiraling out of control, going to jail, ending up in group homes, family members helping you, you're breaking their trust, they putting you out, and it just kind of laid the groundwork for me to keep medicating and not really dealing with what the issue is that I was having at the time. So this one particular time I had got locked up, I was in Rikers Island, and they did an assessment there. And this would be my first time really sharing this on a platform like this, because I really didn't want to claim that. I was diagnosed with MDD, that's major depression disorder. And when they told me that, it kind of registered and made sense as to why I would act the way I would act and respond to certain things. But I really still didn't want to hold that label, so to speak. So stayed in jail for a while, got out, and just kept continuing on this downward spiral with the wrong crowd and not addressing the mental health. So my substance abuse got worse. It graduated from just alcohol to marijuana. Now I'm using powder cocaine. And that's when I really started seeing, I think you might have a problem here. And I thought that if I could just go somewhere and get clean for a few months, then I'll be okay. I could come back out and use like normal people. I should be able to have a drink, happy hour, and go home and be fine. And I've tried and researched that avenue for so long, and it just never worked out for me. And long story short, I ended up here in Georgia, and I went to this treatment program called Trinity House. And it was ran by a gentleman named MZ Tate. But by the time I got there, my case manager, his name was Brother Ali. And it was a very Afrocentric, militant type program. You had to sit with your hand in a diamond. You had to come down at a certain time. And I'm like, man, I don't know if I wanna do this right here. But I stayed with it. And I started taking the suggestions that I didn't take before. And while I was there, I got involved with the program. Of course, a lot of people know about Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. And someone heard me share my story. And they said, you would make a good forensic peer mentor. And I'm like, well, what the heck is that? So they said, it's someone that goes into prisons, they do this and that. And I said, well, you know, the state's not gonna hire me. I have a record. And they was like, well, that's good, because you need a record to qualify for the job. So I was like, ooh. Here goes my resume. Here it is. And I got the job, and the people there at the office, as she was stating with her relationship with Christian, they saw something in me I didn't even know was there, you know, and they started utilizing me in different areas. And I just got in where I fit in with that, man. And, you know, I'm not like this mental health guru or anything, but I do know sometimes the people I've encountered, they would think that mental health is just oh, as long as you're not depressed, you're good, or you're supposed to be happy all the time, supposed to be positive vibes all the time. And that's not really real. I can be sad and still be mentally stable. Mm-hmm. I can be depressed and still be mentally healthy. What it is for me is functioning and learning how to function while I'm going through those emotions without sabotaging the job, without sabotaging relationships. So mental health is taking care of yourself, like showing up for your commitments, keeping your word, being trustworthy, eating healthy, intentionally, you know, just doing things that you know you're supposed to show up for. To me, that's taking care of mental health.
Well, I like what you said about the self-medicating portion mm-hmm. of it, especially when you were young. Mm-hmm. And so when you were growing up, was mental health even a discussion at the table? Or was it just like, we don't talk about that, just figure it out on your own?
It wasn't a discussion, but I had a cousin who lives with mental health. And, you know, my experience with him was kind of like, oh, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I need to stay away from you. And it kind of casted like a dark cloud over him, so to speak. Not saying he's a bad person, but because of the stigma. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't really something we talked about. You might see it, but it wasn't like a discussion. It was something kind of just like, shit. You know, so.
I talked to my mom about that this week. Mm-hmm. She was born and raised in the Dominican Republic. Mm-hmm. And I was asking her about, you know, what was it like? How was alcohol treated? Did you ever witness addiction? You know, all that kind of stuff. And she's like, people were drunk, she goes, first of all, it was men, if they were. She goes, we would just call them borrachos. And everything is so secret and hush hush. She goes, I don't even know if I ever knew of women like really drinking, like, you know, like we would have never known. Everything is such a secret in minority communities with people of color. Like, we're just shh, 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 shh. And if somebody is crazy, it's like, oh, loco viejo, like, you know, just crazy guy, stay away, you know. But if it's happening like in the home, it's very, very much a secret.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I shared this one time before, you know, you hear the term of, oh, well, this is someone who lives with mental health, or this is someone who has a mental health. I like to use a phrase that mental health lives with me. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I am the landlord, the property owner. I hold the deed and title to this piece of real estate called my mind. So at any given time, as long as I'm nurturing that, then I have control and say so of what goes on in my life and not a diagnosis someone gave me. So
I was a part of this art show a while back that mm-hmm. was, I think it was called Words Are Hard. Yes. And it was about mental health advocacy through creative expression.
Okay.
And I remember the guy leading the discussion. He opened by saying, who in here has mental health? Mm-hmm. And a few of us raised our hands. Some people didn't. And he was like, well, if your hand's not raised, you're wrong. He said, everyone has mental health. So like, it's just a matter of, are you mentally healthy or are you mentally sick? Like, are you unwell, right? And so when you have a diagnosis, that can be viewed more as, okay, you know, your mental health is more on the sick side. Versus if you don't have a diagnosis, it might be more balanced. Not to say if you don't have a diagnosis, it can't get off kilter, can't get off balance. But I liked what you were saying about, you know, being in charge of this real estate of your mind. It's like, if you nurture it, mm-hmm. you'll be well. And it's just depending on, you know, everyone's real estate looks different. And so it's like, if you live in an apartment, you don't have to mow the lawn, right? Yeah. But if you live in a house, you need to mow the lawn.
Yes.
So if you're someone that deals with depression on a daily basis, your toolkit of getting ready for the day each day might look different as opposed to somebody who doesn't deal with depression.
Correct.
Or someone who deals with anxiety. Different Absolutely set of tools.
Correct.
You know, you don't want to bring a lawnmower to the apartment. What's it going to do?
Yeah.
It's just going to probably fuck shit up. But that nurturing, you know, through, you know, how you speak to yourself, how you speak about yourself, the food, you know, being intentional about what you're eating, what you're doing, how you're acting, showing up in the world. I think that's all important, regardless of if there's a word on a sheet of paper that defines your list of symptoms. So coming from a background where it's just not something that was talked about to now being an advocate in this, I don't even know, I was going to call it a realm, but that feels way too out there. In this space, an advocate in this space. Was there an adjustment with your peers or your family of going from, no, we don't talk about this, to you're like, no, we do talk about it and I advocate for it?
I wouldn't say there was an intentional conversation. It just showed up in the way I started living, you know, especially when I was working at the prison, you know, because when I first got there, you know, once again, this being in the field as a worker is new to me, you know. So now I'm like, wow, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? How am I going to do this and that? And once again, as you said, going from a place where it's not really talked about to now you're talking about it. To be honest, you know, just working for the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network, the staff there is like they guide you through that. You know, they don't just throw you out there and leave you to the wolves. They kind of guide you through that. And then the encounters that I had with the peers, when we started having the conversations, it started to not just help them, it was helping me too. You know, and then when you hear them give you the feedback and say, man, I'm glad you're working here, because if you wasn't here, I don't know who I would have talked to. That. OK, so we're getting somewhere. We're doing something. And it's just a weird feeling. I can't put it in words as to what exact place and time the shift happened. I just know as I was working or walking in my purpose, it happened. You know, to give an example of how it happened, it's like a fan, right? You have a fan, you buy it out the store, it's in a box, you take it out and you put it in the room, and at that moment it's a fan, but until you plug the fan into the correct power source, it's just the object taking up space, right? And that's how I was. And if you take the cord of the fan and you plug it in water, it's not going to work. If you plug it in coffee, it's not going to work. You plug it in the ground, it's not going to work. But once you connect it to an electrical outlet, the fan starts to operate. And then once the fan operates, everyone in the room benefits from its purpose. And that's how I felt when I got in with Georgia Mental Health. Before, I was just a fan. But once I plugged into the correct power source, I started operating in my purpose. And the people that I encountered, they started benefiting from me walking in my purpose. And that's pretty much how it just went for me.
I love that analogy so much.
Yeah, me too.
No notes. Perfectly said.
Yeah. All right. We're done.
Yeah. That's a wrap.
All right.
Write that down.
Yeah. Jot that down. Yeah. Save it for later. Post it. But no, that's, I think that's a really powerful way to put it. Because what I was thinking while you were saying, you know, if you're like a box fan, right, it has to go into an electrical source. But if you're a plant, you do need to have the soil and the water, you know, but not coffee necessarily, or, you know, and you don't want the electrical outlet for if you're trying to grow a flower, you know. So it's like, it also helps too with the comparison. It's like, oh, well, he plugged in over there and now he, everything's going well. But every time I go over there, like nothing's happening. And it's like, yeah, because you're a houseplant.
Yeah, exactly. You got to find your power source.
Yeah. Wow. That was very beautiful.
Yeah.
Got me off track now. Oh, man. Well, how, so you mentioned to, you know, the initial hesitation of, you know, the state isn't going to want to hire me. I have a record. So what kind of, when there was a shift of, okay, I'm undesirable because of my record versus, okay, now I'm desired because of my record, like the same thing that made me undesirable is now making me desirable. How did that help? change at all how you viewed yourself and your story.
Oh, man. Yeah. It brought back to mind. I remember I was in Miami, and I had this therapist. It was an older white guy. And he would still talk to me even though I was in active addiction. He would still schedule me to come see him. And he says, listen, if you could just stay clean long enough, I have a strong feeling you're gonna help a wide audience of people that I won't be able to reach. Mm. And I laughed at it at the time. I was like, yeah, whatever. And you know, when you get these charges, you know, once again, society writes you off. They count you out. You got a felony. You got this. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't. So it was like, all right. So now I start settling for the mediocre jobs, you know. And again, back to the analogy, once I started surrounding myself in the rooms I needed to be in and I got a proper network, and I realized, wait a minute. Oh, you can get this job if you have a felony. There's people that would take chances and give you chances, you know, once you show them your worth. You know, I you might like this analogy too. I like using this analogy. It's like if you ever played spades, you have some people, they play with the jokers, and you have some people that don't play with the jokers. And it's funny to me, they call them jokers. And, you know, they would call someone like me a joker in society because, once again, you counted me out. So when you get ready to play spades, some people will say, well, take the jokers out the game. Take the jokers out the game. Yeah, count them out. And then when you have the people that utilizes the jokers, you can almost tell who has a joke in the hand, because the minute you get it, you smile like, oh, man. So when you do count the jokers in, not only am I in the game, but I trump all the other cards in your hand. So now, instead of being a liability, now I'm an asset. The same cards you counted out, when you count me in, I trump every card in your hand. You need me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, man, it's a beautiful transformation, and it's just amazing what one can accomplish when you set your mind to it and you have a foundation and a network of people that genuinely care about you and want to see you win. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I did like that analogy too.
Wow. That analogy was awesome.
No, that is, you know, settling for the mediocre jobs and then being in the rooms you needed mm-hmm. to be in. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents, they've always been a second chance employer. Neither of my parents are second chancers themselves. It's just always wow. something like that they've believed in. And so growing up, I was just always exposed to that environment of, you know, no, these aren't jokers of society. Like mm-hmm. these are real people, and real people make mistakes, and some people's mistakes are more documented than other people's mistakes.
Yeah. And I like that.
And unfortunately, you know, that gets in the way of, you know, especially like finding places to live, finding places yeah. to work. And yeah. I don't know if the space is actually changing, or if it's just because I'm in that room of second chance employment where I'm like, wow, look at all these second chance employers. Mm-hmm. So if it is actually changing, that's incredible. But, you know, it is, you know, we shouldn't be defined by our pasts, because mm-hmm. We've all made mistakes, especially, you know, in rooms like where we are right now. And I'm sure most of our listeners were very familiar with messing up to yeah. An extreme extent. But someone believed in us along the way.
I'm telling you.
I wanted to add that, you know, it's also looking inward and having a willingness and accepting yourself and being able to be honest.
There you
because
go.
I remember... I was afraid of getting a job because I'm like, I have a gap in my employment. I have this gap. How am I supposed to explain that when I'm, mm-hmm. you know, to someone looking for a job? And then I had a little bit of seasoning on my background, if you know what I mean. And so I remember
seasoning.
I remember going into a job interview, and this woman that I met in the rooms was like, just go in there. Tell them you still currently work at this place. Don't mention the gap, and just bring up the background thing. But you know, paint it this way. And I felt so uncomfortable, but I was like, I'm going to just trust what she's saying. And I went in there and I lied. And it just ended up spiraling so out of control. And I didn't get that job. It turned into like a whole, Sarah knows, it was just like a whole shit show. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? I don't have to say, hi, yeah, nice to meet you, I'm Josie. I have raging alcoholism. Mm-hmm. I had to go to treatment. So but what I did was I went into a job interview and I said, you know, I quit blank employer back in February, and I've had this gap because I moved from Norcross back to Lawrenceville. I had some changes take place in my life and I needed a reset. So I have a gap in my employment because of that. And during my reset, I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. I take full ownership. I made a stupid decision. I did this thing. I'm doing this diversion program, whatever it's called. And not just one place hired me. Another place hired me and I had another job offer. And it was just because I was like, this is who I am. Mm-hmm. This is my past. And I'm going to be honest and authentic, because if there they don't go. Want me because of that, that's their right. But at least I feel good about myself, because let me tell you, I did not feel good about that whole situation of me lying. It was just yucky.
Well, too, like that mindset comes from the we don't talk about this. And so it's like we're still actively encouraged by people mm-hmm. to lie about certain things. Like, oh, well, don't tell them about your past. Like, mm-hmm. well, like maybe they won't find out. Like, you know, most places don't actually run the background check. So don't tell them that they're going to mm-hmm. find anything. Mm-hmm. Like, don't check that box that you're a felon, because what if they don't have to find out, mm-hmm. you know? And then, but it's still a gamble of if you are upfront and honest, it's like, yeah, maybe that opportunity shuts the door right in front of you because of that. You know, that's good you were honest, but, you know, hopefully the next place will be more accepting of it. But it's still, you know, I guess like that personal integrity of, you know, do you feel shitty lying about it mm-hmm. or do you feel shitty not getting it because of the whole truth? And so some people are going to be accepting of it. Some people aren't. But if people aren't going to be accepting of you because of who you are, then maybe that's not the room you're supposed to be in. Maybe that's not your power source.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, I'm a believer. You know, I believe, you know, some people say higher power, God, they understand. I just say God. I believe in God, right? And if you're a believer, then the fight is already fixed in your favor. You know, it's like whenever I face a interview or someone in general, I think to a default, I'm always transparent. Sometimes that's good, depending on who the listener is. Sometimes it's not good. But my experience with the jobs, like I'll give you a real life recent experience. I was trying to get my credit straightened out, right? And I called this guy up that was referred to me, and we're talking. And for some reason, he said, well, hey, man, tell me a little bit about yourself so I know who I'm helping. Boom, I told him. I'm a recovering addict, this and this and that. And he says, man, you almost moved me to tears, man, because I'm a recovering alcoholic myself. As a matter of fact, I'm going to give you a discounted rate. And I said, well, yeah, you do that. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, that happened to me when I got new brakes.
Yeah, so sometimes...
Not new brakes.
If you
are... new battery.
If you just, you know... And you don't have to do it all the time, but in certain arenas, like you want to let people know who it is they're dealing with. And if that's where you're supposed to be, that's where you're going to be.
Yeah. Like there is, I work with my parents mm-hmm. and there's clients that we have that some of them know I'm in recovery and some of them don't. Mm-hmm. And recently I had an experience where one of them called me specifically, like it was work related why she was calling. And we were on the phone for a while because mm-hmm. she was sharing with me something that her family just recently went through with addiction and overdose. And the person's okay now, like they were able to reverse it and everything. But she was on the phone with me just like scared. You know, she was so worried about her family member. And in this conversation, I was like, does she know I'm in recovery? Like, have we had this conversation? Mm-hmm. And so I asked her point blank, and she was like, yeah, no, I know. So I'm telling you this stuff. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm like, well, like, if, you know, if you need to give my phone number to anyone else in your family, like, let me know. I've been on both sides of this, you know, but it's like, that wouldn't have happened mm-hmm. if I didn't get honest with her about who yeah. I am at one point or another. I'm not saying she called in. I was like, hey, this is Sarah. I'm an alcoholic, and thank you for calling this company. You know, it's like we establish that rapport and that relationship. Because there's definitely times where it's like not everybody needs to know everything.
Exactly.
But we know, you know, it's like withholding is different than, you know, having a – there's a time and a place.
Time and a place.
There's for a
time
everything. And a place.
Everything. Yeah, I usually – like I'm good at – I've gotten good at being able to like read, depending on how the person says something or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But like with me buying my battery, I was on the phone with a friend, and I was like, yeah, after I get this battery, I'm going to get some stuff for this game night. And the cashier was like, oh, game night? Like, what do you, you know, what are you playing? What are you drinking? I was like, no, none of us drink. He was like, oh, I'm like, it's a sober game night. He's like, well, you know, why? And I said, okay, well, we're a group of alcoholics.
People are still asking why in 2026?
Like, what? Yeah, he's like, well, is there a reason? I was like, yeah, it's we're all alcoholics.
We're all pregnant.
He was like, oh my gosh, you are? He's like, one time I went to AA. Yeah, it's not for me. Like, they're fucked up. I mean, I'm sure you're fine. Blah, blah, blah. And he gave me an employee discount. But it's like, it's just, I don't even know where I was going with that story. But anyway, it was just like,
they're all fucked up, but I'm sure you're fine.
He's like, oh, yeah, it's just interesting how it'll come up. But, you know, it is time and place.
Yeah.
I'll never see him again. So
I love like meeting people in the wild where it's like they give those signs. I'm like, hey, like, are you a friend of Bill? And they go, oh, no, I did those recovery classes for court. I'm like, oh, heard. Okay, sick. Yeah. I'm glad you're doing okay. But yeah, it is, you know, depending on you, because you don't know who you're going to impact mm-hmm. just by being who you are, mm-hmm. you know, because like even something, you know, like, you know, in the addiction area, you know, if you're honest about, like, you know, I'm an addict in recovery, that can, you know, help somebody who might be an addict suffering in silence. Or, you know, if you're, you know, in body positivity, if you're, you know, at the gym wearing the little shirt anyway, even if you feel insecure about it, maybe mm-hmm. that's helping another girl who's wearing a little shirt and she feels insecure about it too.
Definitely.
You know, it's like the just being who you are and being true to you can help somebody in ways that you may never know, ways that you're not aware of in the moment, ways that you may actually be made aware of later. But I think the most powerful asset we have is just ourselves and our stories.
There you go.
And so the asset you have, I'm really excited to talk about the incarceration stuff.
Okay.
Not that you were incarcerated, but that the advocacy work that you do mm-hmm. because of it and the people you're able to help because of that. Mm-hmm. And so are you still working as a forensic peer mentor, or has that kind of shifted roles a little bit now?
It just recently shifted roles. You know, when I was working there, one of the most sad parts of being there is I'm a forensic peer mentor, but I share an office with counselors. These are mental health counselors, right? And a lot of them are women, and we had one older guy. And, you know, they would encourage us that when we go down to the dorms to go in a group, or at least two, don't go by yourself. So I would go down there and I would see how the counselors would kind of interact. They call them inmates, we call them peers. So mm-hmm. I would see how they interact with the peers. And, you know, we'll have these staff meetings, and I would say to them, listen, a lot of you have never been incarcerated. So if someone you're talking to, if a peer you're talking to asks you for something or needs something, you don't want to just brush it off and say, oh, I'll get to it Friday. Or you're their only lifeline. They need you, you know. Like, there was peers that I've encountered that would tell me, man, I don't even know who my mental health counselor is. How is that possible? How long have you been here? 6 months. There's no way you should be there 6 months and not know who your mental health counselor is.
Right.
So when I showed up as the forensic peer mentor, I'm not your counselor, but they were very happy to see me, to the point where one of them said, I can tell you've been locked up before. And I'm like, well, how could you tell? Well, just by the way you walk around here and you know, you carry yourself and the way you talk to us, you know, because a lot of times, you know, prison is big on respect. And sometimes the counselors will get caught up in this back and forth dialogue to where now you're talking down. Mm. And then you wonder why the peers react to you the way they do. They're throwing urine bottles at you, you know, feces at you. Because they have a slot to where you have to open the slot to talk to them. And once they identify who's out in that slot and they don't like you, there's no telling what's coming out of that slot.
Poop?
So anything. So for me, I was always big on making them feel like a person. And I always let them know I was once on that side of the door and there is life after you get out of here. Like, this is not the end of the road for a lot of you. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that you do between now and reentry to society, your outcome is just based on the decisions you start to make. Mm-hmm. So you can start making life work for you while you're in here and have a good track record of making good decisions by the time you get out of here. Because if you're still making bad decisions up until the time you leave, then you're going to almost set yourself up to come back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, working in the prison system, you know, it was an eye-opener, and it was also a reminder for me that, hey, if you're not careful, if you don't nurture yourself, you're just a decision away from ending back up in here. So, you know, just being there was an experience in itself, and it just gave me a constant reminder of there's some people there that need some hope. So when because they used to ask me, sometimes I'll come in a suit, sometimes I'll come dressed like this, sometimes I'll have my jewelry out, and they were like, oh man, Mr. Rob is clean, boy, I want to look like him when I get out of here. And I'd be like, you can, if you make the right decisions. And when you get out of here, you need to stay out, because there's some people waiting on you. Matter of fact, you're waiting on you. There's a version of you haven't met yet that's waiting on you. But you can only meet that person based on the series of decisions you make, and that starts why you're here. You don't wait till you get out to start making those decisions. So
I tell my oldest son's dad, he's currently incarcerated. Mm-hmm. He's in prison in Oregon. And I tell him that whenever he calls, I'm like, he's been in there for 4.5 years. He gets out next year. And I'm like, you've got to start now. You should be doing these things so that when you get out, you know, it's not as difficult of a transition. But he'll be like, oh, when I get out, like, yeah, when this, when that. And he's an addict. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, trust me, I'm never going to want to be here again. It's like, yeah, but what are you doing to change your mindset, to like work on yourself, you know? Because, yeah, we all say that. Like, how many times were we super messed up and we get in a position of like, oh, I'm never going to do this again. And then you do it again, yeah, or you do it again.
I know that
and,
story.
Yeah. And it's like, and this might be extreme because, you know, he's been in prison. His whole thing, his whole entire bit is almost 6 years. Mm-hmm. And God, I would hope you don't want to go through this again, but what are you doing? But he does talk about a lot, like the counselors and stuff. He said, they don't treat us like people.
I know it.
They just treat us like inmates.
I know it.
And they run out of my meds. And I'm going through these withdrawals. And then I can't talk to a counselor. I can't go through this. And I can't go through that. And it's like, it's hard. At the same time, I feel like, you know, damn, he's supposed to be in a program that's supposed to be helping him. And it's, mm-hmm, they're not really doing.
Yeah. They medicate you, they restrain you, they put you in isolation.
Yeah.
They come by your cell and say, how you feel today? Are you suicidal? Are you this? Okay, I'll see you next time. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, how is that getting to the root? You know,
right,
you're just caught up in a routine as you're just here to work, but you're not really getting to the root or addressing the issue with this person. So It's really sad sometimes when you look at how it's set up. It's almost like it's set up to have you be a repeat offender. Mm. Yeah, because if you're suffering with these things while you're there and you're not getting the counseling that you need or the guidance that you need from the counselor, what's going to happen when I'm released?
I think that's the most tragic thing to hear from any industry where it's people working directly with people. Mm-hmm. Because you will hear stories like that at hospitals, doctor's offices, schools, daycares, nursing homes, mm-hmm. like where it's just like, you know, like elder abuse is, you mm-hmm. know, something that gets yeah. talked about in the nursing homes a lot. And, you know, then the same thing happens in the daycares and the schools. It's like working with people. Do you love people? Yeah. You yeah. know, it's like, because if people aggravate yeah. you, this might not be the most helpful place for you to be working.
Yeah.
And because yeah, I've like told people that before, like when I've worked in jobs that primarily were customer service mm-hmm. and, you know, their customers would pull me aside and be like, hey, this person is just regularly just like so rude. Mm-hmm. So I'd pull that person aside and be like, hey, look, let's talk about this. And they were like, well, I just don't like people. Like, I'm not good with people. And I'm like, okay, then go find a different job.
Yeah.
Like, go find a different job. Go do something where you can thrive because it's not here. Like if you can change your attitude, you know, and that was something like that's simple, you know, where it's like it's literally coffee, you yeah. know, it's not serious, it's not somebody's life, it's yeah. just somebody's cup of coffee. Yeah. But when you are actively dealing with somebody's life, and especially people who are incarcerated, it's like they need advocates. So I liked what you said about like the mindset starting before they get out. I hadn't heard that one before mm-hmm. of like decisions they can make before they get out, so they can continue that when they're released because yeah. of what you guys were talking about you can, you know, want something all you want, but what yeah. are your actions saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you don't know how to act better, you won't act better. You can want to act better, but if you don't know how to do it, how yeah. can you, how yeah. can yeah. you do that? And the same thing that we talked about on the show a couple weeks ago with, if you focus on what you don't have, you'll miss everything that you do have. Yeah. And so it's kind of like goes hand in hand. Like, what are the resources you have available to you? Yeah. How can you use them? And how can you learn from where you've been so you don't come back?
Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing you said resources, right? Because there was a time, even still, resources are not readily available as they should be. Mm-hmm. Here's an example. You can go anywhere in this country on any given day, Valentine's Day, Christmas Day, holiday, Mother's Day, no matter what day of the week, no matter what time of the day. If you commit a crime, there is a resource readily available for you 24/7, 365 days a year called jail. But you want to tell me if I'm having a mental health crisis, well, look, it's Friday. Can you make it here Monday? No, mm-hmm. I might not be here Monday. I need help now. Or even people with substance abuse issues. Well, we're closed right now. Can you call us in the morning? No. So what I'm saying is the resources need to be just as readily available as you are to lock me up for a criminal offense. You need to have that same energy when it's time to help me with my mental health or my substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. That should be readily available, just as the prison system is and the jail system is. And that can save so many more lives.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of nonprofits I have started, you know, in the last decade or two, mm-hmm. You know, where they're able to open like hotlines, warm lines, call mm-hmm. centers, and have resources available. But, you know, it's not, you know, it's private funded or funded mm-hmm. through grants or whatever. And so it's like these resources are important and they're available mm-hmm. to in order to keep having them and to have more of them. So they're just as available. Like, yeah. y'all, we got to be donating,
yeah.
supporting.
Yeah. They're donating to building all these prisons. Mm-hmm. Why won't you take that to prevent the reason to keep having yeah. to build a prison? I have never heard a cop say, you know what, we're short staffed this weekend, so we're not going to lock you up today. No, you're going to jail. Even if it's overcrowded, you're going to jail. So the same energy and the money that you take to invest and build in these private prisons, the mindset, not only the mindset of the individual who has the mental health or the substance abuse needs to change, the mindset of the people on how they perceive and look at those individuals need to change in order for these resources to be much more readily available to us, man. It's hopefully it'll change soon.
Yeah.
Well, I think that this type of program and this company, mm-hmm. you know, is important because it gives us a voice and it provides for us to put these conversations out there and, you know, hope that people listen, they can hear,
mm-hmm.
hey, we are people. Yeah. We're not hooligans. We're not.
Some of us are hooligans.
Okay, we are hooligans. I'm sorry. We're not, you know, we're not a danger. We're not. We can recover as possible. We can change. And like, you know, I was doing research about opening sober living, and I was talking to someone and they said, well, this there's like all these zoning laws.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know. I was like, what is that? And I started reading and reading and reading. And it's like as a wiggle, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like to wiggle around the Fair Housing Act, which mm-hmm. is supposed to help people with disabilities and whatnot, which having addiction and mental health falls under, like alcoholism falls under disability.
Mm-hmm.
There's these zoning laws where then the people in that area can be like, well, we don't want to have that type of residential.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want those people in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's really important for us to use our voices and put this out there, because it's like we could be providing more resources, but mm-hmm. because there's still so much stigma,
mm-hmm.
especially it's like if you are an addict, ooh, then you're a person of color who's also an addict,
mm-hmm.
double whammy, because I already felt some type of way about you because you're Black or Hispanic and now you're also an addict.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't want you to bring down the value of our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But it's funny because I was driving with my mom the other day. We were going to the grocery store and she goes, look at these houses they built. They're $1 million. I said, you know what's funny to me? Those houses are $1 million just because they're a nice house and people are moving into it. It's just on a road, you know, nothing. It's not in a neighborhood. It's not mm-hmm. enclosed. It's not in a good school zone. It's there's no value besides how nice the house is. There's no other value for it to be $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to plop that there and people are okay with that and investing and putting money just for – do you see what I'm saying? It's like
yeah.
What? So you want to come into like this area and build $1 million house? You're sticking out like a sore thumb
mm-hmm.
in this community that could use a house mm-hmm. to help others, but we put that there instead.
Yeah, it's like, almost like I'd rather invest in building $1 million house, but you don't want to invest in building $1 million person.
But mm-hmm. there we go.
We're priceless.
Yeah.
You know, you can't put a value on rebuilding someone's life, but you will take that and say, I'd rather invest in putting this home here.
It's not like it's a bad neighborhood, but it's like, what?
There was a post I saw on Facebook this week, and it was from in Jasper, Georgia, and it had a lot of attention to it, and it was just a zoning notice. No, it wasn't. It was a lady posting about the zoning notice mm-hmm. near her house, and it was a sober living was trying to open. And whether this was, I didn't look up the stuff in Jasper, and she could have just been trying to stir the pot, you know what I mean? But I read the comments because I don't respect myself enough. But I was like, you know, she's just like,
same.
They're trying to open a halfway house, and I don't want this in our neighborhood, and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, that's a wild opinion to have. Let me read what these hundreds of comments are on this post that has thousands of different types of engagement to it. And there were people who were advocating for a sober living and advocating for, because it was like someone corrected, she said, it's not a halfway house, it's a sober living. She's like, here's the requirements for people to be residents there. Like, they're coming mm-hmm. out of a treatment program from this place. You know, they'll have like X amount of time. They'll have like, they won't have these types of criminal records and blah, blah, blah. Like, it's perfectly safe. And people, and it was just so, and she was like, you know, keyboard warrior in, like, against all these people of like, I just don't want these people around my kids, like, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to see, like, in real time, it play out like the stigma is still very much alive. Because I'll forget, like I'll be in this little recovery bubble and I'll forget the stigma is still real until mm-hmm. like encountering somebody who still views us as less than because we're addicts, regardless of recovery or not. And then it was really cool to see people who were advocating for the importance of housing like that, for the importance of an option like that. So while the resources available to addicts and alcoholics and people coming out of jail, like while those resources are still kind of budding and needing to grow, what would you say the community could do to help the community out?
Research.
Okay.
You know, get outside yourself. You know, it's all fun and games, and you can speak out against it until it affects somebody living in your house. You know, it's, oh, those people this, those people that, until it affects one of the people in your house, until it's your child. Now you're the biggest advocate for the soul. Why did it take for it to affect your home? What about the other people there? So, you know, I would just suggest, you know, like I said, just people learning to get outside themselves and doing research, like really stepping out in your community and finding out what's going on around you and not just living this bubble of, well, you know, I have these group of friends. We live like this, so I'm gonna just click with this. And you know what's funny to me? I'm an animal lover, right? You would see more love for animals than for the humans. Yeah. You have some people that would nail you to the cross about just not dumping an animal, rehoming it. Just trying, I can't take care of the animal anymore. Oh, you should never get a dog that you can't take care of. Well, where's that emotion for the guy on the street that needs help, that wants help to get clean? The sober livings are being built for people who want it. But now that you're seeing the people want help and they're building these resources from the get the help, you're advocating against that? Like, that doesn't make sense. So, you know, again, just, you know, people would just really have to get outside themselves and look at ways to uplift the community in itself. Because when you uplift the community, you uplift yourself too. Don't just wait for it to hit home to want to do something about it.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. And I love that you brought up the animals too. Because, mm-hmm. yeah, people are very quick to, you know, animals can do no wrong. But, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, I had to rehome a couple of cats when I was mm-hmm. drinking. And I was like, because I couldn't afford to take care of them the way they deserve to be taken care of.
Trust me, I know the you feeling. Know?
I was like, I was going to have to, you know, get lower quality food, lower quality litter. Like their standard of life was about to go way down if mm-hmm. I kept them. So it wasn't good for them. But there are people who are like, well, you should have never, like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, when I got these cats, I didn't know my life was going to go the way it did. Exactly. And I'm so like, and it broke my heart. But too, like, because LB, you walk into a room. And you tell somebody, like, oh, I hate people. They'd be like, me too. Me too. People are the worst. You walk in a room, I hate dogs. What is wrong with you?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, whoa,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Watch all out.
Right. All watch right.
out. Don't so you it's dare.
Like, it's yeah. like one of those phrases. And it's like, do you hate people actually? Mm-hmm. Or are you just hurt? Are you annoyed? Like, are you feeling another emotion that where it's just easier to be like, I hate people, and so yeah. you don't want to help? Because I think that's too, like, you know, that echo chamber you're talking about of just being like, oh, okay, well, me and my friends, we all get along, and we agree on these things, so this is what we're going to talk about, and we all agree, and everything is fine and dandy. But then there's no diversity in that. Mm-hmm. And so there is, you can't advocate for people who you don't know exist. And so if yeah. you and your friends have never done nothing wrong, have never been arrested, have never dealt with abuse, you know, and you don't know that we exist other than the way the community has ostracized us or whatever else opinion you may have, not from firsthand experience or lived experience, you can't help. If they're in your community, what are you doing with your community outside of your echo chamber? And that's why I think, like, what I love about what we do here with the podcast and everything is getting to meet people from all sorts of walks of life
there
and hearing about perspectives and stories that I didn't know that was a path that was an option for people to take and be like, oh, wow, I never went down that path. What's your experience been like? Wow, I never experienced something like that. What was your experience like getting help? Because then you hear like what the stumbling blocks are from all different types of way. And it's just that reminder of just to be kind, like just a simple act of kindness can go so far, you know, just like holding the door open for people, which is pretty common down here, but holding the door open for people, saying hi, saying please, saying thank you, you know, just like the basic courtesies can go much further than you think. Cause like, I will never forget the first time someone looked at me like I was less than human, and that will stick with me forever. But I'll still, when someone's kind out of nowhere, that sticks with me too. And so it's like, how do you want to stick with in someone's brain? So how else could the community be advocating for the people around them?
How else could the community be advocating for the people around them? Just be a support. You know, be a listening ear, be open-minded, you know, and once again, be willing to accept somebody's perspective of what they're going through in life and how they're dealing with life, and see what ways you can do to help them. It doesn't always have to be something financial, you know, so, yeah, that's all I really got on that part about what they can do. You know, just once again, being an opening ear, opening mind, and just looking intentionally for ways to help someone that may be a little different from you, or because we all have vices, we all have issues. So don't crucify me because mine looks a little different from yours. Right. You know, we should all be able to, or be willing to, help one another, no matter what the situation is. And once again, if it's not financially, you just might have an idea. You might know someone. You might be able to, well, look, you can go this way. I know this place. Just have a willing and opening mind and heart, man. Yeah.
And knowing people and connecting people.
There you go.
That's community.
Yeah, because just like with the jobs I got now, it wasn't about what I knew. It was who I knew. It was the people in the community that helped me get to where I'm at. That's how I ended up here.
Me too.
You know what I'm saying? That's how I ended up on the podcast. Someone heard me and said, hey, so here we are.
Yeah, I mean, between addiction recovery, mental health advocacy, and life after incarceration, those are the three big taboo things that, you know, people don't really want to talk about outside of the little recovery bubble. So I think, you know, that is important work that you're doing with your, with the advocacy and helping people where there isn't much help to give right now. As we come in for a close, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wish we did, or something you want to leave the audience with?
Something I want to leave the audience with. Show up for yourself. You know, I show up for work. I show up for the boss. I show up for the bus stop. But for some reason, when it's time to show up for the gym, I'll hit the snooze button. When it's time to show up for things that I know I need to take care of, I'll procrastinate. So make it this time to be just as intentional. Show up for yourself for once. Show up for yourself. And in closing, I would say that I hope everyone who has listened to this podcast or who has access to it, my sincere hope would be that you heal from things no one has ever apologized to you for.
Wow, that was beautiful. Seriously. Rashad, where can people find you if they want to connect?
I don't want you to find me. No, I'm just playing.
Oh, God.
I'm just
You're playing. Like, I'm here for you.
That is a wild way to ask it.
I ask everybody.
I know. It is entertaining every time.
You want to find address. Me, you can reach me by email. It's Rashad, R-A-S-H. AAD, as in dog, Newman, NEWMAN, 193 at gmail.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone who tuned in. Thank you to our donors and our sponsors. And thank you to the Georgia Opioid Crisis Abatement Trust. I finally memorized it. Wow.
Just in time for your just last in time. Day.
Yes. And make sure to connect with Most High Media on social media, Instagram, Facebook, subscribe to the YouTube channel, and download the Most High Media app for more recovery-related content, and make sure to share with others. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope I will see everyone soon. This has been the Most High Show. Thank you.
Hey.